Welcome to Nashville and Beyond.
I'm Brian Copeland.
And I'm Zach Copeland.
And we're a father-son duo helping people buy, sell, and thrive in Middle Tennessee.
But this isn't just about business. It's also about our family and our community.
It's a front row seat to how we live, work, and serve right here in Music City.
So buckle up as we explore Nashville and Beyond.
I remember buying you that sweatshirt. I got that in New York, I think. Yeah. I remember seeing it going, you're hard to buy for.
I am.
But I saw it and I'm like, you know what? I think you'll really like that.
Yeah.
So you're in blue today.
I am. Show it off. Everybody, you can see.
Hey. The American Museum of Natural History in New York.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Amazing, amazing.
So, you know, we went there with the family. You didn't get to go on that trip for some reason. There was some reason you didn't want to go, but... When you think about family, what's the first thing that pops into your head?
Oh, gosh. The first thing that pops into my head is Mike and Esther.
Aww.
Yeah. That's the first thing that pops into my head. You know, I love having a brother and sister that are so much younger than I am.
Yeah.
Gives me a sense of protectionism. And, you know, I'm very protective of them both. And, I care deeply about both of them. So that's the first thing that I think about.
So yours is very concrete. Mine's very abstract.
Okay.
Because for me, it's a brand and feeling. When I think family, I think that's just the backgrounds that we come from.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a warmth I feel. When you say the word family, I don't see anybody's face. Because you think, oh, you see your mom's face or your dad's face or Greg's face. Or I don't see a face. I feel... a very warm feeling, and it's I see color in my head when I hear certain things, and in this car I get brown, which is a very warm tone, a very common tone. It's a comfort tone. It goes with a lot of things. So for me, that's when I think family is kind of weird. That's how my brain thinks on it.
Okay.
So
okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, family looks different for everybody. Sometimes it's the one that you're born into. Sometimes it's the one that finds you. And today we are talking about family, the joys, the messes, and everything in between. So let's start here. When you think of family, what does that word mean to you? That word family?
Yeah. And it's such a cliche question, but really when you, I'm real big when people look at me and say, well, how are you doing today? The response is always, well, fine. I want deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we think family, I think if people want to go in those cliches and say love or belonging,
that
those
made me
of things,
think of dad, by the way.
What? Did?
When you said, oh, expected response is I'm good, thanks. Because we always ask dad, how was something? And he goes, it was good.
This is a conversation. Yeah. So for me, you know, family is so much deeper.
Yeah.
Because I come from roots that are so deep.
Mm-hmm.
They go into, you know, those East Tennessee hills, and you have a relationship with that environment that created your family.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've listened to Dolly Parton's America podcast, which I would highly recommend, it really digs deeply into that notion. So when I think family, I think deep roots, environment, and the foundations that has made the family that you're actually a part of today.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, you know, I've got quite a complicated family history.
Yeah.
You know, my biological father, who I don't have any contact with or any kind of relationship with, was actually adopted as well.
Okay.
And so I don't have any knowledge of the family history on that side, any kind of medical history on that side, things that are kind of important to know. Mm-hmm. Just as an adult, you want to know about your family's medical history because it can impact your medical history. On my mother's side, you know, I know my mom and grew up around her family and was able to, you know, trace back through Ancestry.com, was able to trace back, you know, like 18 generations of our family all the way back over into Scotland. And so that was pretty cool to do that. But, you know, family is a pretty touchy, has been in the past a pretty touchy subject for me, especially before I met this family and became a part of this family.
And for me, it's, you know, completely the opposite because, you know, I was raised over in hills of East Tennessee. My dad has six brothers and one sister. So he was seven boys, one girl. My mother, my mom and dad married when they were in their teens. Mm-hmm. My mom's dad had to sign the permission for them to get married when she was 15. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that family started really young. My mom was a grandmother at 39 years old.
Wow.
Go do that math.
Wow.
39. My mother will likely see great, great grandmotherhood. Mm. So family is such a robust piece of my history. So, you know, my nuclear family was me, mom, dad, and Brad. We were a Southern gospel singing group. Mm-hmm. So most of my nights, you know, Saturday night, we had a singing every single week over there. There were these in this culture, it's called a singing. Mm-hmm. And you say, what is that? It's an event that you go to, and there's just singing groups there. Mm-hmm. And we would set up, my brother played the bass and drums. My dad played guitar. We sometimes bring a piano player with us. And that was our family thing. Every single weekend, Friday nights, we were doing revivals. Often on Thursday nights, we were doing revivals. We were in our home church on Sunday. So faith and family was very core of everything. Every Sunday afternoon, we would go over to my grandparents' house, my mom and Papa Copeland, and it was a treat to see what cousins would show up, because I had cousins my age, girls and guys both, and we would sit and play. It was a huge thing. I mean, every Sunday afternoon was a blast. My grandparents had these orchards over in these big open fields, and we'd go get the apples off the trees and the pears, start eating those. My grandfather was a one-armed woodworker. He lost his arm in an electrical accident, and so he would have this shop to build all this stuff in. And so to go through that shop and smell the cedar, that was a big piece of family for me. And then, you know, on my mom's side, my Aunt Carrie Jane was a hoot. She would sneak and listen to Alice Cooper records.
Okay.
And back then, you know, that wasn't full of Jesus. We weren't allowed to listen to that.
Uh-huh.
And so I remember Aunt Carrie Jane would take us into her bedroom, because she was just a few years older than us, and she'd pull out her Alice Cooper albums, and we'd sit and listen. Sorry, Mom, we did that. I'm not sorry now, because you think it's funny.
Confession time.
Yeah, you know, so my Aunt Carrie Jane was kind of our, you know, and then I talked in our Thanksgiving episode about losing my grandmother at a younger age. You know, Mama Ridner was a big deal. She loved to travel with us. You know, the things with my Papa Ridner were always... it was tough. Mm-hmm. Papa was a very harsh man, but as he got older, he turned into one of my best friends.
Yeah.
And I remember in his struggle with colon cancer and taking care of him in his last days, and just the love he poured out on all of y'all, and just the man he was. You know, so family for me, and I feel bad talking about it in front of you, because my family background has been so great.
Yeah.
So yeah. Great with cousins and who just became best friends of mine. Family's spectacular for me.
Yeah, good. Yeah. It's good that you've had that.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to acknowledge the realities of your family dynamics. And
you're reaping the benefit of that now, though.
I am reaping the benefit of that now. You know, and that's something I'm thankful for. We talked about that in last week's episode for Thanksgiving. You know, for me, family growing up, my mom and my biological father got a divorce when I was 3 or 4 years old. My mother remarried when I was 5 or 6. Pretty quickly, she moved on. You know, my biological dad divorced my mom because he was gay. You know, I grew up from basically until I was a teenager, well into teenagehood, probably 16 or 17, grew up experiencing every garden variety of trauma and abuse that you can imagine. And whether it was, you know, mental, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, those were all things that I experienced.
Yeah.
And it was tough, you know, especially because there was a lot of religious trauma too. And I think people don't think about being in a household where, you know, you're told that gay people are these awful, terrible, disgusting gay people. And here I was, a little gay boy, and I'm like, oh, y'all are talking about me, and you don't even know it. And I'm sitting here under your own roof. So, you know, once I came out at Thanksgiving, I talked about this last week, you know, suddenly for the past 18 years, all of the family that I had kind of disappeared and disowned me, essentially abandoned me. I was working at this church in college when I came out. I was a keyboard player for them, an organist actually, pipe organist. And my family members called the church and said, hey, We know that your organ player is gay. He just came out to us, and you need to fire him, or we're going to cause a stink. You know, this vehicle that I had gotten for graduating high school with all A's with like a 4.0 GPA, you know, there was this agreement that I had made with my mom and my stepdad that if I got straight A's, that I would get a car when I graduated high school. So I did that, fulfilled my end of the agreement, and I got the car. I came out, they came, took the car away. Stopped supporting me financially, you know, no grocery money, no rent money, anything like that. I didn't have a job because I didn't have time for a job because I was a full-time college kid in a music program.
Right.
So, you know, that abandonment from family really was kind of a catalyst for me in a period of my life where I didn't want a family because that was a bad word to me. It was a word that had no meaning, an empty shell of what it was supposed to mean. And so, you know, I went through all of my 20s on my own.
Yeah, you did.
Without any familial support.
Early 20s, yeah.
Yeah, without anybody to call on or to say, hey, I need somewhere to go. I need somewhere to land. Yeah. I need help. How do I navigate being an adult? How do I navigate getting an apartment on my own and setting up utilities on my own? You know, how do I get car insurance? How do I do all these things that you expect family to be there to help you know how to do? So I had to do it all on my own.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the things I've struggled with you a lot on is trying to rebuild a strong early core memory for you when I can't.
Yeah.
And that's something Greg has actually said to me. It's like, you cannot rebuild his childhood. Mm-hmm. You're not responsible for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about the time when we first took you to an amusement place with rides and everything, and you have some trauma from going to an amusement place. And the time that you stepped behind something, you kind of broke down, and I'm like, what's going on, buddy? And you're like, well, last time I did something like this, this traumatic thing happened. Mm-hmm. And us talking through it and understanding that while we're reshaping, you'll always have your memories. Mm-hmm. We're reshaping your new memories. And while it may seem weird that, you know, you're given this dichotomy of sadness and I go over here to my side and I'm going to talk about, and it's a lot of happiness, but that's part of our story where we get in the next segment of this podcast actually. But for me, growing up, it was again, just the complete opposite. My history, my mom and dad, you know, they were kids. They were teenagers having kids. And so there were things they wanted to do as kids that they were now free from, you know, because my mom wasn't allowed to go to dances. My dad wasn't allowed to do any of that stuff in their family. So when they got out on their own as teenagers and then they had kids, they wanted to enjoy life. So I was strapped to the back of a motorcycle when I was 2 years old. I mean, car seats did not exist.
Yeah.
We would be in the back of my mamaw's Nova, and she would have that cigarette lit up, and the windows would be down. I'd be laying in the back window of that car, and, you know, no safety measures. It was just living life. You know, after church, Dad would let us ride on the roof of the car home, you know, with our feet tucked in. We would go to Kmart and buy a blow-up inflatable raft that we would blow up with our mouths. That's how flimsy it was. And put it in the Clinch River and just go tubing down all four of us. And not knowing the rapids, not knowing if there's a waterfall. It was just carefree life and fun.
Yeah.
Your mom would, you know, nobody drank in my family, but my mom would love to act drunk. So she would get out these fake bottles and drink it and act drunk and fall around the kitchen all the time and be like hiccuping and all this stuff. She would let us get out the pots and pans.
I need that to happen again.
Yeah. She'd let us get the pots and pans out of all of her cupboards, and we would drum and play for hours. And she would sit and play with us because she was a kid too, you know. And so, you know, and then I remember every time on Wednesdays, Dad got paid. He worked at Lockheed Martin, Martin Marietta, which was a contractor for the U.S. Department of Energy. He got paid every Wednesday, and he would go to the Family Dollar in South Clinton, and he would pick us up a little dollar gift, and we could not wait for him to get home, not just because we obviously wanted to see him, but we knew he had that little dollar gift, and it'd be like an Army guy, or it would be a Matchbox car or something, and then he would sit on the floor and play with us with it. He wouldn't go sit and watch TV. He wouldn't. No, what he did. On Saturday mornings, if he had an electrical job, we would go out, and he would say, now, in these electrical boxes, there's quarters that have fallen out because they were these metal boxes, but you had to take out that circle and it was the size of a quarter. Mm-hmm. And there'd be metal, and we just would, he would tell us they were quarters, and then he would like trade in those quarters for money for us.
Yeah, that's,
you know, so
sweet.
I learned to run. So while I was running conduit and I was laying block, I was having fun with my dad. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of chores became, or work things became spending time together. You know, they take us to cattle auctions. There's very few memories I have of my childhood that are bad. The memories I remember that are bad was when I was misbehaving over at my mamaw's house or in church somewhere, and they was go stand in front of the refrigerator after we get home, because that meant there was discipline coming. Mm-hmm. I remember those, but it was so rare. I remember telling my mom when I was mowing the lawn, when she told me to mow it in a certain way, and I yelled to her, "Go mow it yourself, old woman." I remember that. That's a core horrible memory that she continues to tell and laugh about, but she made her mad. When I only can say like two things that were trauma in my life, there were pets that died, that kind of thing. But I feel guilty here in a situation like yours, because my life growing up as a child was so unbelievable. We were dirt poor, but I had no clue because there was just so much love. Mom would make, we would run out of electricity or couldn't pay the light bill. She would get charcoal and make hamburger helper over the grill so we'd have food, and we'd laugh about it. It'd be fun. So, you know, everything was just great.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad that it was great for you. You know, there is a contrast, obviously, between your upbringing and my upbringing. And, you know, one of the things that I fantasize about often is how my life would have been different if I had been raised by you and Greg. And, you know, the reality is that I can't go back and change home, and you can't go back and parent me the way that I should have been parented.
Yeah.
And I can't go back and unlive the trauma that I lived. They're real experiences, and they shaped who I am. You know, but that's how family has shaped us.
Yeah.
And it's maybe in my case, it pushed me to build something new. So when we come back, we're going to talk about the family that we have now and what that looks like in our day-to-day lives.
Oh boy. All right. So family evolves, you know, we've talked about it in the last segment. The older you get, the more intentional you become with family.
Yeah. You know, it's not just about who's related to you. It's about who chooses you.
Wow. And who chooses to stay.
So let's talk about the family that we've built together. I'll let you kind of guide this story of the Bullard-Copeland family dynamic and how everything came to be.
Yeah. So our, you know, Greg was previously married to a guy named Ken. They built their ministry together. Ken did the music at the church. Greg was the pastor. They'd moved from Alabama, previously Memphis before that. One night, Greg got the call no one wants to get, that Ken had died in a car accident, and just completely devastated him. We had both moved to Nashville the same year. We lived in the same neighborhood. Everything had never crossed paths because he was with Ken.
Yeah.
And so a year and a half passes, and after that car accident, I had a car accident. I was driving some friends around, and we were at Church Street at the corner of 17th and Church, and a car T-bones us, and I'm the driver, and it sends us flipping. And so we spent the night in the hospital, and we all came out okay. One still has some issues from it, so shout out to you. We love you. We said that next weekend there was a play at the church that Greg pastors. I didn't know anything about it or anything. And my friend Jeremy said, why don't you go to the play with us? Let's do something positive together. So we call it the world's worst play ever. Greg still this day calls it that, but Greg was there.
Was he in it?
No. Oh. Could you imagine?
called it?
It's the world's worst play. Yeah. Oh, shade. So we met there, and We went on a date the next week, and we've been together ever since. We went on a cruise to Alaska once. And on that cruise, Greg said, would you ever have kids? And I said, you know, we were already married at this point and everything. And I said,
and how old were you at the time?
Oh gosh, I'd have to do math. I was in my, early 30s.
Okay.
About your age. Because we've been married for 20 years. Yeah. So about your age. Yeah.
Okay.
About right. And he said, you know, I said, would you ever have kids? And we both agreed that if they fell in our lap, we would, but we weren't going to go searching for kids at all. Mm-hmm. It's just trauma. There wasn't a lot of two dad families back then, you know, it was rare. That was our mentality. So we're at the volleyball game over near the Piccadilly cafeteria that used to be over on Murfreesboro Road. Shout out to that. We miss you, Piccadilly. Come back. And we get a call from a friend of Greg's who's also a pastor that says, hey, my niece, you know, we have a son, and that same niece that had that son is about to have another child. And we were curious, would y'all be okay adopting this child? And we're like, well, I wasn't there at that point. Greg took the phone call. Yeah. And Greg comes back and says, the baby just fell in our laps. We're going to adopt a child. I went, okay. And so I breathe and watching the volleyball game, like, okay, we're going to have a child. And Greg's like, I think it's like, you know, we've got like 6 months. And this is July at this point, like the end of July. Mm-hmm. He goes and calls Jerry again and comes back and goes, I've screwed up. The baby's going to be born in 6 weeks. And so we literally went to Walmart that weekend and got a baby bed and started the home studies and all this stuff. And before we knew it, it was a whirlwind of stuff happening. We hadn't met Micah's now deceased mother, Casey. At that point, we had to get down to Georgia to meet her. We had to get our attorney, our home state. This all happened in a few weeks. And that's a miracle because sometimes it takes years. So we had Micah. Micah comes home, and that's how that family started forming. And then, of course, about a year later, we're like, we don't want Micah to be raised alone. We want to have another child. So we actually went through foster programming, and we thought that was going to be our route. That we would adopt an older child. So we did foster a young man who went to Hunter's Lane here in the area. And it just didn't work out, unfortunately. We wanted it to. He ended up in some trouble, and I found myself in the school office one day with him doing some illegal things. And the look on his face was so sad. He did reach out a few years later and apologize and say, y'all were the best thing that ever happened to me. Mm. And I think he would have been in our family had he not been taken back into custody on no control of ours. So we was like, hey, we want to have another child. So we were able to locate another mother in a situation, and Esther came along. So Esther was easy. You know, we were there during that pregnancy, and she came home and was born on Greg's birthday, May 28th. So they share the same birthday. Greg says he's stuck in time because Esther took his birthday, so he doesn't age.
Okay.
And so that's kind of how this nuclear family of ours was formed. And I'll let you take it from there.
COVID hit, and y'all needed a musician at your church. This was months before COVID hit, probably 2 months before everything shut down. You know, y'all had some change in personnel at the church, and you sent out kind of
called Wayne.
Yeah, you called Wayne, and you said, hey, Wayne, we need a keyboard player to kind of fill in while we look for something more permanent. Wayne knew me because I had been working in the gospel industry for a couple of years at that point, and you know, I had met Wayne and we had hung out and become friends, and he called me and said, hey, there's this church, you know, it's an affirming church. It's a little bit smaller, but they can't pay you much, but they're just, you know, they need somebody to fill in for a couple weeks. So I went and filled in and, loved it. Loved y'all. Everybody at the church loved me. It was wonderful those first 2 weeks, and then COVID shut everything down. And so for the next 7-8 months, it was literally just me and Greg and a audio engineer there making services happen. And we were all in separate rooms, and there were remote video feeds that mm-hmm. the audio video guy had set up so that he could just, you know, control everything from an offsite place. And you know, I started to get closer to Greg at that point. You know, I'd gotten a place to live through this transaction. And I really started to like Greg a lot and value him and his expertise and his advice, because, you know, as I was listening to his sermons, because I was there, because I had to play, I really hadn't intended on being involved in a church. But as I started to listen to his sermons, I started to understand, you know, that I had learned a lot of really, really crappy theology, and that it was detrimental to, you know, my emotional, my mental, my physical, my spiritual states, and that it was possible for me to unlearn that bad theology and replace it with good theology. And so, you know, I started spending more time with Greg. Slowly, we were able to start introducing people back into the church. I started to meet you. I started to meet Micah and Esther. I loved Micah and Esther from the very first day that I met them. I was terrified of you when I first met you. And we've talked about this.
Yeah. Most people are scared of
you. Yeah, most people are scared of you. You can be pretty intimidating. And I think it's just you know what you know, and it is what it is. You just know it.
Yeah.
And you're very matter of facts in many ways, and that can be intimidating to some people. But I started to fall in love with Micah and Esther, and then I started to spend time with y'all at the house, and you know, the relationships kept developing and kept growing, and I was spending so much time with y'all.
And then there was a day that came, and you said, and I learned about your, because there was a point where I'm like, we got to get him out of the house that you're in, because it was, we need it for another purpose. And I'm like, get him out. And Greg's like, no, I will never do that. And I was like, why? He's like, you don't know his history. And I started learning your history and being like, okay. And then, you know, you and I took a trip to LA where I could get to know you. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh gosh, you know, I see why Greg really sees this. Because you were calling him like your dad. And I'm like, this is weird to me. Mm-hmm. It was just weird. I didn't understand it. You know, especially when we're looking at, you know, gay families, people put stereotypes and they're like, oh, this is a young guy coming into this family. What's that about? No, this was truly a family situation where it's like, we have someone in need, and this is not our first time having someone young in our household mm-hmm. who needed help.
Yeah,
and it's nothing reciprocal sexually. Those kind of things, these gross things we hear, because we hear gross things. Yeah,
people can make stories up.
And we had to really put that to the side of God. Like, we can't worry about what people will want to grossly put in their head, mm-hmm. and it's frustrating.
Yeah.
We have to focus on, and I got to know you. I'm like, okay, I see why he thinks of Greg like a dad, because of his history. Oh gosh, he needs a family. Mm-hmm. And we started talking through that, and it was years. And one day we're driving down the road and you say, would you ever consider adopting me? And it kind of hit me like a rock. I'm like, oh gosh, really? What? And I would never, and you said, I don't want anything. I don't want inheritance. I want nothing. I just need a place to belong. And so, and this is well after we knew you. I mean, it wasn't like the first year or whatever.
Yeah, it's like 2.5, 3 years.
Yeah, well, it took us a year and a half to decide
yeah.
on the adoption piece. And so you know, I talked to Greg about it, and he goes, yeah, this is a big decision. And so we just sat down with it. And I think, not to be over spiritual here, but I think one of the things that God commands us to do is to stand still. I'm always moving. You know me, I'm a goal person. Let's get it closed. In this situation, we had to stand still, and we had to let the crock pot just sit. Mm-hmm. And you didn't say another word. You didn't say anything. And we were on our way to Rehoboth Beach, just the two littles and me and Greg. And on the way back, Greg's like, it's time. It's time. We need to adopt him. So unbeknownst to you, we started this process. We met with an attorney, all this stuff. And so it came time to tell you. Mm-hmm. And so again, you had no clue because you hadn't thought about it. So it was Easter Sunday, and the kids, the little ones, were in on it too. We were going to do an Easter egg hunt for you, for Esther. But the way I'd framed it to you, to Zach, was we're going to let Esther get the golden egg.
Because she's got a trip she's going.
When you go shot, we're going to frame it as, there's a journey. We'll give her this trip as a surprise for her. Mm-hmm. And we'll give it to her a little bit early. It's around her birthday, but we'll give it to her a little bit early. But go with it. You get the blue egg. Micah's going to get the pink egg. Let Esther get the gold egg. So we go down to the table, and I have cameras in place because, again, you think that we're taping Esther get her surprise. Mm-hmm. We get to bring it in, and Micah opens his egg, and it says, we're going on a journey. And you do this face on the video going, oh, wow, you're so cheesy.
Oh, you know, Esther, where are you going?
And Esther's a great actress. She's a great actress. She can cry on, you got to be careful with her. And then you open your egg and it says, and the journey includes us all. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh, Esther. And so Esther has a big golden egg and she starts struggling with it. And she's like, I can't open it. And she goes, Zach, open it for me. And so you're like, you get it popped open for her. And then she just completely shuts down. She goes, I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do it. You open it. And you're like, Esther, you've got to open it. And she goes, no, you read it. No. And I look, and on the video, you hear me say, Zach, just read it for her. And you open it up, and it's the adoption invitation. Uh-huh. And there's this, in the video, there's just this silence. And then you just start bawling your eyes out. And we all start bawling our eyes out. And you had sat for a year and a half without knowing what was going to happen. Uh-huh. And there's this big surprise. And this silence of just, yes, yes, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the adoption happened really fast. You know, I think we were done within a month of that time. Yeah. Because adult adoption's a lot easier than
so
we
thought. So much easier. Yeah. Especially in some states, it's not possible.
Is it not?
Yeah, it's not a thing in some states. And I had made sure to look and see if it was possible in Tennessee before I even asked that question. But, you know, it's a very easy process. I will say the most difficult part of that process for me was telling my mother.
I know.
And breaking that news to her. Yeah. And telling her that I had changed my name and that I was legally adopted. And I remember her saying, you need my permission to do that. And me telling her, actually, I don't. And the next few moments on the phone call of silence where, you know, there was no audible noise, but I could sense that the reality of what was happening was sinking in with her. And she was realizing that she didn't have any control over this. It was out of her hands. And that she was no longer legally a parent to me.
What would you say to the mothers who are listening to this podcast today, who don't know the full story of everything that may be in judgment on you right now?
You know,
I may have to edit this out. So,
yeah, the mothers who are listening,
because when you just say that story, they don't know your full. We know everything.
Yeah,
but when someone hears, I just call my mom and say I got another family, and she was like, "Oh, it hit her."
Yeah,
I'm sitting here as a mother going, "That was really insensitive."
Yeah,
what would you say to that?
So, I would encourage people to you have to know my story, and listen to. If you've listened this far in the episode, then you've kind of heard some of the things that I endured and experienced as a child, and then as a teenager, and then as a young adult. This for me was not about.
It wasn't spiteful.
No. It wasn't about me needing to be rescued from anything. It was about me finding belonging and people who loved me and valued me and who were constantly pouring into me, and realizing that, you know, there's such this awful cliche that, you know, your family is blood, and you should never, you know, you always have to remember your blood and take care of your blood. And I just, you know, that's just not true anymore. In the world that we live in, there's chosen family. And I chose this family, and they chose me. And I just want people to understand that, you know, I didn't do this to hurt anyone. I did this to heal myself.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of time to process and to think through what the implications of that were, because the last thing I ever wanted to do was to hurt my mother. And, of course, her being who she is, she saw it as, you're doing this to hurt me. And that just wasn't true.
Wasn't at all.
My motives for this had nothing to do with her. It was about, I need to be healed and I need to experience true belonging and true family and true unconditional love. And unfortunately, that was just something that she could not provide to me.
Yeah.
It was not something that she had the capacity to provide. Because of the environment that she was in,
Geopolitically, the environment that she's in. It's still in to this day.
Relationships.
Religiously, the environment that she's in. You know, all of these things that, she has assigned a high value to in her life, those things assign a low value to me and to who I am.
Yeah.
And because she values those things so much, it means that at some level, she cannot truly value me and who I am and what I have to offer. And, you know, just like, you know, we talked about, you can't change my childhood. I can't change her childhood.
Yeah.
I can't change how she is and how she was raised.
Yeah.
And I accept it and I love her and I wish nothing but the best for her. And I hope that she has a very successful life and continues to thrive. But for me, this is what I need to move on and to heal.
Yeah.
So,
and I think the answer, you know, that I would give if I were, didn't have to say it, is you don't know the road that Zach has walked. Because I know listening to, I know there's a lot of moms who listen to this, and I know your kids, and your kids are 16, 17, 18 years old, and this is a fear that someone could have. And I just have to say, if you are a mother, and this is a general statement, when your child is going through something in life, make it about that child and what they need. Because, again, these kids are 16, 14, 13. Don't make it about how it makes you feel. And I remember helping you through the messaging of when you're going to talk to your mom. And you know, if any of your family's even listening, we don't know who's listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, I want them to know that we've had talks about us actually being together with your mother and seeing how we can meld those pieces together. When I've tried to open those doors, there's been some doors closed due to situations that we won't go into on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But just know it's very complicated. And when you hear the statement of, I called my mom and said, hey, we're done here, it's not that cut. That's why I wanted to dig deeper into this.
Yeah, it's not that cut and dry.
You know, and your story is not a rescue story, as you said.
Yep.
It's a relationship story.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's tough, but let's move on to the next part here, which is, you know, the lessons we've learned and the happy parts that we've learned. So I'll start with what I'm wearing today. You can see here on the camera very clearly. It's clear. It's clear. You don't have to move anything. It's very clear on the camera that I'm wearing my five shirt. And so I'm real big about building culture with family. And so I had this design done, and in the sleeve of it here, again, you can see clearly there, it's got all of our birth dates and the times we came into this family, and it creates the number 55 when we add all those together. So where there's five of us, and then there's a 55, which represents the year that Zach was adopted, Mike and Esther were born, and that Greg and I joined together. And it just happened to make that. So I'm real big about culture builds. I'm real big about making sure our family does things that that are memorable. That when we talked about Thanksgiving, I think we talked about it last week, I talked about some of the traditions we were missing because I wasn't in charge of those pieces. But I believe when we're looking about lessons with families and the happy parts, it starts with culture. And I'm real big about, you know, it's when we go on trips together, we're together. We're going to schedule things together. While everybody may not want to do the same thing, we're together, because I think a lot of families are missing culture. And there's, you know, we have a no electronics rule at the table when we eat. Now, of course, we break it sometimes because there's a funny TikTok video that we all sit and laugh over, but we're all sharing it together. You showed a video of us last night of what was the little boy, what was his name again, Lawrence or
Walter?
Walter. Yeah, and he like falls over.
He fell off the table. Yeah. I love videos of kids.
You know, and so, but we were, that was a social object that we were culturally coming around. Some of our funniest things come, like one of our, you know, sit team is the opposite of standing.
That
came from a video we were watching together in culture. So as our family, we can say, you know, sit team is the opposite of standing. And we're like, you know, there's all kinds of little cliche pieces.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, those are parts of the happy parts.
Yeah, well, you know, when you experience something like I've experienced, and another, there's other people out there who've experienced similar things. You learn what it's like to redefine family on your own terms. And you learn that love doesn't always come from blood. Unconditional love, I'll say. You know, there's certainly conditional love that comes from blood, but true unconditional love doesn't always come from blood. And I learned that. I would love to hear from you, because we haven't really talked about this yet, how adopting an adult kind of changed your perspective of parenting and of what family looks like. Because, you know, I am an adult, and you adopted me as an adult, so you didn't have, as we've mentioned, any influence on my upbringing.
Well, 101 in adoption is you never trump birth order. You never adopt a child older than another, than your oldest. And we we messed that up. So that's one thing I've had learned. Micah is very sensitive about being called the middle child. We can't use that term with him. Mm-hmm. I always call him my first born into the family. Mm-hmm. Very careful, because he's very sensitive about it, because he was always the oldest kid. Mm-hmm. Until he was like, 11 or 10. So I'm very sensitive about that piece. But adopting an adult comes with you were raised with different conflict resolution pieces, where I remember one of our first conversations about conflict, you were like, I want to know immediately, don't let it jail, don't let it sit, you got to tell me immediately what I did and let's talk about it at that moment. And that's not how I was raised. Mm-hmm. I was raised where we think through the conflict, we reflect on it, and then we find ways to find grace with people where we don't really have to resolve it, because it's resolved through love.
Yeah.
Because I can say, I always use the cliche of one red sock can turn a whole load of whites pink.
Yeah.
And I can't allow one bump in life erase all the great. And that's been one of my frustrations of adopting an older child who has your background, is I can mess up something, and it feels like often that my one mess up cancels all the wonderful things I did in the past year that proved I love you and I'm here for the long haul.
Yeah.
So that's been a growth piece. It's just, you were raised in a different parenting style than I was. Our family values as parents together and as we were raising children were very different from yours. And you've had these moments of like, because you look through eyes of punitive damage of like, this is against me, mm-hmm. instead of, no, this is for me. Mm-hmm. And we constantly have to remind you of, whoa, we're not your enemy here. We're not here to hurt you. We're here to help. And I know in the past this has been the history. That's not where we are now. Mm-hmm. How do you, hearing that from me, how does that feel on your side?
I mean, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I did grow up in a very punitive household where, it's dad talks about people see the religion as fire insurance, as a get out of hell free card. And that kind of philosophy and that kind of theology was a huge part of how I was raised, where you have a list of things that you can and can't do, and the reason is so that you don't go to hell,
right?
So that you don't get hit, so that you don't get beat. And there's no love from that. And so the contrast of that style of parenting versus y'all's style of parenting, which is very, we want to push you to become the best version of yourself that you can be. It's incredible. And, I think one thing that we haven't talked about that kind of is important for people to know, and it's the family episode, and I've not talked about this publicly yet, so I'll go ahead and talk about it now because it's the family episode, is 3 years ago I was diagnosed with autism. And in that diagnosis, it kind of helped me understand some of the behavioral patterns that I have, processing patterns that I have, some of the comfort level things that I have with social gatherings and with communicating and how I read people and read emotions and respond to people. That's been something for y'all to have to work through too as well, because there are times when I can just be very emotionless and very cold and matter of fact, and it doesn't come from a place of wanting to hurt anyone's feelings. It's just kind of how I process things in the immediate moment. And
I often have to say, Zach, this is what an apology looks like. Because mm-hmm. usually, I'm sorry. And it's like, this is not what an apology, or I don't know what I did wrong here. And I've had to say, okay, this is how, and you brought up the autism piece. I've never mentioned it to anyone. I have to sometimes give you things. I always say, let's open our toolbox.
Yeah.
And what can I put in your toolbox that you can pull out later? Mm-hmm. And I say, now this is what an apology looks like. An apology isn't, like, well, I don't know why you feel that way. An apology isn't, well, immediately, I'm sorry. An apology is, Zach, I did that to you and I hurt you. And I know I did that. And I don't know if you can forgive me right now, so I don't know if I can give you an apology right now, because I don't know if you'll take it as sincere. So I will take some time, but know that I'm beginning this sorry process. And when you're ready to hear that apology and know that I mean it, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's what apology feels like. It's not like, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay, I forgive you. It's not that. It's a true peace. And I think you've been in a mentality of, we got to get this fixed because I don't want to have the punitive damage just happen to me, whether it be physically, sexually, mentally, emotionally. And here you're like, you're waiting for the hammer to fall. And you're like, oh, it didn't fall.
There was never a hammer.
Yeah, there wasn't one there. So, and then I think through, Micah, and we were on a walk the other day, and out of the clear blue sky, he says, I hope I'm a dad like you one day. He goes, I really appreciate the way you and dad treat me. He said, you treat me like an equal. You don't treat me like some kid. You let me make decisions. And he goes, I just want to say thank you. And I'm like, I called my mom and dad, and I said, this was a talk I didn't have with y'all until I was probably in my 30s. But to have that call, that conversation with a 13-year-old, saying that, it meant a lot. And hearing you say things like, I'm learning, and we don't get it right as a family all the time, but we know how to show up for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned that, especially our family, none of us are biologically tied.
Yeah.
And we know that there's always that side of family we talk about, which is our blood family, mm-hmm. but there's also that side that we choose.
Yeah.
And when we come back from break, we'll start talking a little bit more about the family we chose. Okay, so as I was just saying, some of the strongest family ties come from people who just decided to show up for each other.
Yeah, exactly. The people who you choose, the people who earn a spot in your life, those are the ones that really kind of make it feel like home, that add to that sense of community, that sense of belonging. So I want to hear who's in your family life now that's, maybe not by blood, but by bond.
I want you to go first.
Okay. I would love to. For me, it's, all the people at church.
Yeah. I was going to say Charles, Victor, them. Yeah. Those are,
Charles, Victor, Greg, Charles, Victor, Jackie, Linda, Elton, William. All these people are people who always show up, who, give me birthday cards. These are the people that I invited to my birthday dinner. Laura, people that I value. I value their input. I value their guidance, their wisdom, their counsel. And there's something, if you're a young person in your 20s or 30s out there listening to this podcast, and you don't have friends that are older, and I mean 20, 30 years older, you're missing out on such a treasure trove of life experiences and perspective that you just can't get from people your age or people younger. There's something so valuable about having people in your life who have experienced a lot more life than you, who can really offer perspective on such a range of things, from dating to financial freedom, stability, to politics, to community building. We tend to get so wrapped up in our experiences, and we forget that there are people who have lived those experiences already and who have survived and who have thrived out of those experiences. And finding those people and asking to hear their stories, asking to hear their experiences, is going to make you a better person. So to all those who are listening, who are those people that I just named, I love you. Thank you for being in my life.
And we purposely left off a very important name because there's a whole piece about you there. And I know you're probably listening going, you're talking about family, you're not talking about me. It's Share Powers.
Yeah.
And we were coming to you because and that's why I wanted Zach to go first, because Safe and Share for me. Sharon Arden, mm-hmm. While Share is your godmother,
He's a godfather, basically.
We don't give him that title, but godparenting really came from more of a Catholic faith area. Mm-hmm. And while we're not in that faith zone, we knew as dads, as a two-dad family, we had to have a strong woman in our life who would want to be a part of our children's life. And we literally made a long list of women in our life. We knew it couldn't be like Mimi or, somebody like that, because they're already in the family. Mm-hmm. We needed somebody who was going to fulfill a role, but we're like, who doesn't have children? Who will want to invest in kids in a way beyond just, the basics, here's the name and the title. And it kept going back to Cher every step of the way. And she's a friend of mine in real estate. We met for real estate deals. But she just became part of mine and Greg's nuclear group. Greg married her in Arden at a sunrise ceremony on the balcony of their river home back then. She just was family to me and Greg. And so it just was so, it kept coming back to Cher. She was the first name we wrote down, and it finally just came out. And when Micah was born, we wrote, she was at the birth in Jessup, Georgia, which is 10 hours away. And we handed her a piece of paper that was written in Micah's supposed handwriting as a baby saying, "Will you please be my godmommy?" And she just broke down crying, and she's like, "Absolutely." Oh. And she was a choice that we made. And then, of course, when Esther came about, it was obvious. And then when you came about, you know, it's like you had this bond with Cher and Arden, because Arden and you are super close.
Yeah.
And Arden fulfills, like, well, you're really close to my dad, Papaw. You're very close to Arden because he's the one coming over. It's like, hey, let's work on this together and helping you understand walls and where they go. And you're working on projects with him a lot, that kind of thing. So, you know, that chosen piece has been huge because, you know, Cher's tough. I mean, she doesn't care to tell you how it is. Mm-hmm. She's not just there just to write a check or give a Christmas present or a birthday present. She's there to be there for the hard talks. And so when you came about and Cher was like, can I? Yes, you're going to be Zach's godmother. And she's been such a huge part of our family. You know, the art that you have in your home that represents them, there's just a lot. And then we can't talk about family without talking about Emily.
Emily.
You know, Emily came to our family through a Facebook group when we needed a nanny for Esther when she was a baby. And Emily is like your sister. You know, she always when I'm saying, you know, when she hears me on the phone arguing with you about something, she goes, "I never see that side of Zach. I just love him." You know, and you know, Emily has been with our family now for 10 years.
Yeah,
and you know, you can talk about that if you want to. Her, Cher, and Emily. Yeah,
yeah. Cher, I love Cher. Love Arden. Really enjoy spending time with them and. Always happy to see them, especially at church. Yeah. Hint, hint.
Yeah, she's been not following
that. And, you know, Emily, I've gotten so close to Emily over the years, too. I think at first, I think, you know, Emily and I have talked about this. I think there was a little trepidation from her that perhaps I would be a replacement of her.
Yeah.
And that was not the case at all. Obviously, she's still around. And, you know, we, you don't know this, but Emily and I vent about y'all to each other.
You should. Yeah, I hope so.
Because we, you know, we have to talk
y'all
about
have
it.
Have somebody,
and,
yeah.
And you know, we both love those kids, and yeah, they're all three of those are just wonderful people. Yeah. So,
and Emily, you know, Emily's like our daughter. If Emily hadn't got married to Michael, we and her parents would kill us because her parents are amazing. I would totally adopt Emily.
Yeah,
because Emily's amazing. I can trust her with my life. And Emily, you know, she's taught me a lot about parenthood because, you know, she married a man who lost his wife in a death, and he had a son. So she became the mother to that. And then she had a baby named Parker, and Parker died shortly after Parker's birth. And we want to keep Parker's love and life alive. Emily and I talk about Parker every single week. Emily just closed on their new house. They just bought a house. And we were talking about how do we bring Parker into this home? Because Parker's a part of our family, too. We miss Parker a lot. We think about her a lot. And we, she was very important to our family. She was going to be my first grandchild. Mm-hmm. And, we always saw it like that. I have dreamed about, you know, I hadn't had a baby in a long time that I could just take and just take care of and be like, hey, y'all go away. We're going to take the baby for 3 weeks and you go away. Parker was that child for us.
Yeah.
And so losing Parker, I don't get to talk to Emily a lot about it because I try not to be emotional about it because she needs that strength. But I miss Parker.
Yeah.
I think about where she would be starting kindergarten and those kind of things. So, you know, family comes in all forms and shapes. You know,
does.
We didn't weren't born. Nobody was born into these families, but with Emily, Cher, Victor, Dan, everybody at church.
Yeah.
All this new, they just become chosen family. And I got to snot a second. You take over.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, family always has to come first. And in many ways, that's true. But sometimes it shows up when it needs to, right on time, and not always first.
Yeah.
And
let's lighten the mood. Yeah.
let's move on to some family themed Nashville rathers, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So would you rather have advice from your parents or lessons that you have to learn on your own the hard way?
Oh gosh. Man, that's a hard one. Advice from my parents or lessons. You know, it's about life phases. And I think there was points in my life where I wouldn't wanted to listen to my parents. And I look at you and I know sometimes I could say things to you, but it's not going to go because you're like, you know, I'm going to do this anyway and I'm going to learn. And sometimes it's just 10 minutes. It's not like weeks of learning. Sometimes it's a simple lesson of 30 minutes. And then you'll circle around and say, gosh, you know, you won't ever admit that I was right. Sometimes you will. But with them, gosh, man, this is a tough question. Had you asked me at your age, I would have said I would want the life lesson. Mm-hmm. But now I just want mom and dad's advice to tell me, mm-hmm. don't do this. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, for me, that's a difficult one to answer too, because, you know, I just talked about how valuable the experience and the wisdom and the counsel is of people who are older than you and your elders and your parents. And while, you know, I think that is pretty true for the most part. I think we're also at a point in the development of civilization and humanity where there's been such rapid technological changes over the past 20 years that things that I would perhaps ask y'all about, if it were 100 years ago, you would know exactly what to say to me, because from generation to generation for the past 1,000 years, experiences hadn't changed that much. Over the last 100 years, each generation experiences life in a totally different way. You talk about, you know, the Industrial Revolution, and then you talk about the advancement of TVs and media, mass media. Then you talk about the internet. Then you talk about AI. All of these changes that are so large scale that happen so rapidly, it's hard for me to ask dad for dating advice because the people he was dating didn't have apps.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't, you know, it wasn't like they had a menu of, you know, selections they could choose from at any point. So, you know, I think for the most part, I would take advice from y'all. But there are some lessons that I just want to learn on my own, and it is what it is.
One more, and this is a tough one. I think you may have a hard time answering it. Would you rather have a family weekend together retreat-like where we're together talking about deep issues, or would you rather have a family trip together where we're going off doing something fun together?
Oh, that is a tough one. Gosh. I don't know. I think I would probably do the fun trip, to be honest. That's what would work best for me. So I think having the excitement of being on an amusement park roller coaster or something like that, Knott's Berry Farms. I was just thinking about that the other night. I want to go back so bad. So
yay. Well, I didn't know what you would answer with that one. But, you know, family's not one size fits all. It's a tapestry, a quilt, a mosaic of people who have shaped us, who have hurt us, who have healed us, and who've chosen us in your case. Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to think family was something that you were born into. And now I know that family is something that you build piece by piece.
And as long as it's built on love, it doesn't matter how it's built.
That's right.
It becomes exactly what you need to be at the time you need it.
That's right. Well, we'd love to hear about the family that you've built. Send us pictures of your family. If you have furry family, you can send us pictures of them too. By that, I mean pets, not furries. So please send us your pet pictures. And the audio guy's laughing his head off right now. So yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Give us 10 out of 10 stars or 5 out of 5 stars or, you know, whatever the rating system is. Rate us the best.
And we haven't forgot about family, pets as family. We're doing another episode on pets.
Yeah, we
so
are.
Don't
we are.
Think we forgot your pets. But that's it today for Nashville and Beyond. Thanks so much.
We'll see you next time.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It does not constitute legal, financial, or real estate advice. Listeners should always consult licensed professionals for guidance specific to their situation. Brian and Zach Copeland are licensed real estate agents with Compass 615-522-5100. Kevin Kinnerson, MLS number 171733 with Lendingham Mortgage, is the executive producer. Engineer Mike Reeves. Music Dusty Boots by Eco Leaks, Nashville and Beyond, copyright 2025.